Joe Biden gets a medal, John Lewis gets a tweet, and some 50-plus House Democrats get to stay home. Happy inaugural week on The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. There have been some 228 years worth of presidential inaugurations. What were some of the more memorable ones?
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Plus, as the Trump cabinet hopefuls face tough questions, one former unsuccessful nominee reflects back on the confirmation process.
When the whole issue of the woman living in my home came up, this was not like it had happened the day before I got the call from Governor Bush. My problem is that I didn't tell in the vetting process.
And as Democrats search for a new national chair in the age of Trump, what can the party do? One candidate for party leader makes his case.
The first time in New Hampshire history, we now have an entire Democratic congressional delegation. And that's why in 2016, we were able to push back against the national trend.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 162 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. It has been one of the most dispiriting post-election periods in memory, and last weekend's back and forth between Donald Trump and John Lewis only adds to the collective sadness. Lewis is a Democratic congressman from Georgia who, as everyone knows, was severely beaten in 1965 for his participation in the Civil Rights March to Selma. Taping a segment for NBC's Meet the Press, he said this last week to host Chuck Todd.
I don't see this president-elect as a legitimate president.
You do not consider him a legitimate president. Why is that?
I think the Russians participated in helping this man get elected, and they helped destroy the candidacy of Hillary Clinton. I don't plan to attend inauguration. It would be the first one that I miss since I've been in the Congress. You cannot be at home with something that you feel that is wrong.
That's going to send a big message to a lot of people in this country that you don't believe he's a legitimate president.
I think there was a conspiracy on the part of the Russians and others to help him get elected. That's not right. That's not fair. That's not the open democratic process.
First, for the record, Lewis has boycotted inaugurations before. He skipped George W. Bush's swearing-in in 2001, also because he questioned Bush's legitimacy. But back to the present. You know that whenever Donald Trump is attacked, he responds in kind, and then some. In his familiar tweet voice, he disparaged Lewis as, quote, all talk, 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 no action or results, which is pretty remarkable in itself. And he added that Lewis should focus on his own congressional district, which was, quote, crime infested and, quote, falling apart. Let the record show that this feud was just days preceding the national holiday honoring Dr. Martin Luther King. Let me also add that I don't even think Trump's response to Lewis was my favorite tweet of the week. That goes to CNN Tonight, which tweeted, and I'm not making this up, quote, is Donald Trump's feud with Representative John Lewis going to hurt him with the black community? I'll get back to you on that one. Meanwhile, just days before they were set to leave office, President Obama surprised Vice President Biden by presenting him with the Presidential Medal of Freedom with distinction, the nation's highest civilian honor. It was a fitting ending to their White House bromance, as Obama would call it, and Biden was deeply moved. Of course, Biden famously gave Obama a variation of his own award back in 2007 before they were teammates.
I mean, you got the first sort of mainstream African American who was articulate and bright and clean and nice-looking guy. I mean, that's a storybook, man.
Yeah.
But once Obama picked him as his running mate...
A man with a distinguished record. A man with fundamental decency. And that man is Joe Biden.
They've been a close working team, as close as any in history. Here was the president last week in honoring his number two.
If you can't admire Joe Biden as a person, you've got a problem. He is as good a man as God ever created. So, Joe, for your faith in your fellow Americans, for your love of country, and for your lifetime of service that will endure through the generations, I'd like to ask the military aide to join us on stage. For the final time as president, I am pleased to award our nation's highest civilian honor, the Presidential Medal of Freedom.
That was a real emotional moment. And that's also our segue into this week's trivia question. When Biden was elected vice president in 2008, he had served nearly 36 years in the Senate. Who was the last VP who had that much service in Congress? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned.
I never thought I'd find the road to freedom. Never thought I'd see you smile again. Never thought I'd have the chance to tell you.
We're recording this week's program just days before Donald Trump is sworn in as the 45th president of the United States. Given his unpredictability as a candidate and as a president-elect, we have no idea what his tenure will look like. But for all the stunning surprises we've witnessed during the campaign, for the most part, presidential inaugurations stay true to form. After all, we're talking tradition here. Of course, sometimes someone can screw up, like the Chief Justice of the United States.
I, Barack Hussein Obama, do solemnly swear.
I, Barack Hussein Obama, do solemnly swear.
That I will execute the office of President to the United States faithfully.
That I will execute.
The office of President of the United States faithfully. And will, to the best of my ability. Preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
Preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
So help you God.
So help me God.
Congratulations, Mr. President.
And sometimes the person being sworn in gets sick and dies 32 days later. That's what happened to William Henry Harrison, the nation's ninth president, who had the longest inaugural address, more than 8,400 words, and the shortest presidency. This is the only piece of historic tape I could find of Harrison, recorded not long after his inaugural. Can't believe I did that. For more inauguration talk, we're bringing in Matthew Dalek, an assistant professor of political management at George Washington University here in the nation's capital. Matt, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Thanks for having me.
All the norms of political campaigns seem to have vanished in 2016. But when you think of the presidential inauguration, as I said earlier, this is really about tradition.
It is, although the tradition has evolved and in some cases evolved quite dramatically over the years. So it used to be held in March. The 20th Amendment to the Constitution basically said it would be held on January 20th. It was not always held outdoors. The president, you know, back in the early days of the early republic, the president did not always do it in public. And as you started on your tape, Justice Roberts, you flubbed the oath, and so Obama the next day had to redo it, basically privately, to make sure that for posterity that they got it right. So it does evolve. But yeah, I mean, I think your point is well taken. Trump, for the most part, and we'll see, but he seems to be sort of, this is in keeping with how the inaugurals of the past several decades have gone. But there are some notable differences as well.
And we don't know, of course, how, I mean, so far, I think they've been civil to each other, but there has been a history of bad blood between the outgoing president and the incoming president.
Yeah, so I think the popular impression of inaugurals is that they're these kind of kumbaya moments, right, when the country comes together and the outgoing president and incoming president, that everybody is sort of one and we're all Americans. But, of course, that's not necessarily the reality. In 1933, Franklin Roosevelt and Herbert Hoover drove to the Capitol from the White House, and they wouldn't talk to each other. They were so icy toward one another. And Hoover then spent many years, if not decades, railing against Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal. And this week, I think, we will see not just the hundreds of thousands of people for the Women's March the day after the inauguration, but we could see protests, significant protests, maybe more than we've seen in the past several decades, on the inauguration day itself. And we also don't know, you know, what Trump is going to say. And given, you know, what he has been saying on Twitter and what he said during the campaign, that I think is a real wild card. But, yeah, I think my sense is that President Obama and Michelle Obama are committed not just to being physically present, but to being as kind of civil as possible, to sending a message to the country that this is a peaceful transfer of power, although there are approximately 60 House Democrats who are refusing to attend in protest.
Well, let me play a little piece of tape of President Obama talking about the easy transition.
I committed to President-elect Trump that my administration would ensure the smoothest possible transition, just as President Bush did for me.
So obviously there's a sign, at least from the outgoing president, there was a sign that he wants to keep that tradition going. But what happens when President Trump, for example, learns that the inaugural address is more than 140 characters?
Well, I think hopefully he and his team have figured that out by now. Look, on election night, he did give, or the morning after the election, when he accepted victory, he did give a speech talking about unity, and it was coherent. My guess is that he may very well give a similar kind of like-minded speech that attempts to wipe away or at least temporarily make people forget about really the toxic tweets that he has been saying, in which he's been attacking not just political opponents, but, you know, demeaning a civil rights icon like John Lewis, going after like the cast of Saturday Night Live. I mean, attacking people who are not even technically in the political arena. And so I think there is at least a little bit more drama in that sense, given, you know, who Trump is. And that's sort of the way he likes it.
You mentioned the possibility or perhaps the likelihood of demonstrations. I think, well, at least in my memory and in recent history anyway, I do remember sizable anti-Nixon demonstrations in 1969, mostly based on against the war in Vietnam. And, of course, there were demonstrations against George W. Bush in 2001, given how he was elected with the Florida recount, the Supreme Court, things like that. But they seem to pale to the kind of divisions that I see in this country right now.
I would agree with that in terms of 2001. And remember, you know, George W. Bush's approval ratings after Al Gore conceded were pretty reasonably high, given that he lost the popular vote and that there was this election contest in Florida. I mean, Bush's approval ratings were, you know, in the 50s or maybe even at 60%. Al Gore gave a very gracious concession address. Bush, I think, took steps to try to unify the country in that moment of division. And so even though there were some protests, I think they're going to pale in comparison to what we're going to see over the next several days, especially on Saturday, the day after the march. In 69, I think it's a different dynamic. Now, you know, the protest of Nixon's inauguration itself may not be nearly as large, but there were, of course, massive hundreds of thousands of people protesting year after year. We had political assassinations of Martin Luther King, Robert F. Kennedy in 1968. the Vietnam War in 69 and 1970 was divisive, so hundreds of thousands of people would protest at the Pentagon and elsewhere around the country. They'd burn their draft cards. I do think that the 60s, you know, for all of the superficial comparisons, you know, there is something to this idea, you know, of a resistance, that, you know, people are going to be kind of taking to the streets in nonviolent, peaceful demonstrations in protest of what they see as deeply immoral acts and actions on the part of the incoming president. And so there is a linkage.
You know, I mean, we always think of how the ceremony of the inauguration is. Not everyone is memorable, of course, but do you have some particular inaugurations that you find more memorable than others?
Well, you know, I think there have been probably five inaugural addresses that have really been memorable, you know, with lines that kind of last. So Jefferson's, "We are all Federalists, we're all Republican," you know, this idea that we are all one after this bitterly divisive election, that we're all Americans. And I think that sentiment has kind of come down through the years to the point where, you know, you hear Obama talking about how committed he is to doing everything he can to make this a smooth transfer of power and to ensure the integrity of American democracy. Lincoln's, well, both his inaugural addresses, but especially in 1865, really the tail end of the Civil War, where he talks about a God and each side praying to their own God and the divisions of the country and how God, in a sense, maybe had punished the United States for this original sin of slavery. That obviously lives on Franklin Roosevelt's, "Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself." That, I think, lives on, and in part because of the context of the times, the economic emergency, 25% unemployment.
"So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself."
Matt, that was pretty remarkable and most memorable. I also think of John F. Kennedy's inauguration in 1961. Let me play a little bit of that.
"The energy, the faith, the devotion which we bring to this endeavor will light our country and all who serve it. And the glow from that fire can truly light the world. And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country."
One reaction I have is that both of those, Franklin Roosevelt's and John Kennedy's statements, there was a formality to the language, to the construction, almost Shakespearean in a sense. That formality in spoken communication, you know, that is really no more, right? You know, you can't imagine, you know, a president sort of getting up there now and the inaugural address saying, you know, "Ask not." It just seems very forced. But of course, the other thing is, Kennedy's in particular, it resonates in part because it captured, I think, this generational handover from Eisenhower, from the older World War II generation to the younger generation. Kennedy's inspiring, especially young people, to in the country and around the world to volunteer, to work, to make their country better, and in a sense kind of inspiring the civil rights protesters, the free speech protesters, eventually the anti-war demonstrators, this idea that citizens could take their democracy and make it their own. And then I think Ronald Reagan in 1981 made a significant statement when he said, "In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problems. Government is the problem." In basically a single sentence, in a couple phrases, he encapsulated the conservative anti-big government philosophy that galvanized him, galvanized the conservative movement. And in some ways, I think that statement echoes today, this idea with a lot of Americans that government is the enemy, is the problem. And, you know, we need to kind of take the country back from this overweening, overreaching federal bureaucracy.
How important, Matt, do you think that the tone and the language and the words that Donald Trump will use?
Well, they're important. people will be paying attention, and I think it will filter down to millions of Americans whether or not he sends a message of unity. And then, of course, there's the substance, which is how will he follow through on that message? So, for example, in his victory speech on election night, he did send a message of unity. The markets actually rallied in response to that message. But since then, that message has really dissipated amid the flurry of tweets that, you know, where he has impugned the intelligence community, likening, you know, American intelligence agencies to Nazi Germany, where he has attacked a union leader in Indiana. And so the words that Trump says, I think, will matter, but probably more important will be how he governs in the days and weeks afterwards and what kind of tone he consistently sets, because we may have a speech that is very kind of kumbaya-esque and talking of unity, and yet there is very little, if none of that, in the days to follow. And one important thing to look at is how does Trump respond to the protests, both on the day of the inauguration, but more importantly, even probably the day after, with this hundreds of thousands of people at the Women's March.
Matthew Dalek is an assistant professor of political management at George Washington University. He is the author of several books, most recently Defenseless Under the Night, The Roosevelt Years and the Origins of Homeland Security. Matt, it was great having you on the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Ken.
Talk in everlasting words and dedicate them all to me. And I will give you all my life. I'm here if you should call to me. You think that I don't even mean a single word I say. It's only words, and words are all I have to take your heart away.
Democrats in the Senate have made it clear they have strong objections to several of Donald Trump's cabinet picks. Jeff Sessions about race, Tom Price about Obamacare, Betsy DeVos about education, Scott Pruitt about climate change, Andrew Puzder on the minimum wage. Whatever you think of these nominees and their ideological leanings, many have agreed to make huge sacrifices, financial and personal, to join the administration and to serve the new president and the country. That's the way it's always been. Often they make the right decision. Sometimes it doesn't work out well. That's what happened to Linda Chavez in 2001. A conservative commentator and a former candidate for the Senate from Maryland, Chavez was nominated by George W. Bush as Secretary of Labor. But she ultimately withdrew when it was revealed that, for 2 years, she had sheltered a person who was in this country illegally. It was a difficult moment for Chavez, the chair for the Center for Equal Opportunity, a nonprofit conservative public policy research organization. And she joins us now to talk about it. Linda Chavez, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Thanks so much, Ken.
Don't you love starting off an interview with great memories of the past?
Well, it was, it was one of those things that happened when people say to me, you know, do you regret it happening? In fact, I don't. I think my one regret was that I should have alerted the Bush team to the fact that I had taken this woman into my home. I had provided her with, you know, shelter, and I'd actually helped her find a job with a neighbor, a woman who happened to have been a big Democratic fundraiser, and I think that is how the story ended up breaking. I don't regret taking Marta into my home. I was contacted by a mutual friend who knew of her situation. I think at the time she was in a women's shelter. She had come to the United States fleeing an abusive relationship, marriage in Guatemala. And then when she got here, she found that she really was being harassed, sexually harassed. And so she ended up in a women's shelter. And I'm glad I took her into my home. And if I had it to do over again, I would do it today.
I would say, but even before this situation here, you know, I mentioned the names of the several Trump cabinet nominees who faced strong Democratic opposition. When you were named to head up the Labor Department, you too, I guess, along with maybe John Ashcroft, but the two of you were the target of the left.
Absolutely. And you know what's interesting? When then Governor Bush sat with me in Austin and offered me the job of Secretary of Labor, he said to me, they're out for blood and they're going to get one of my nominees. And everybody thinks it's going to be Ashcroft. I think it's going to be you that they're going to go after. And that was very insightful of him. And it turns out they were right. That was right. And I think it's unfortunate that instead of going after me based on policy differences, based on the fact that I had conservative views on a variety of issues, instead it was the kind of personal attack. And, you know, it happens on both sides of the aisle. We saw that with Tom Daschle. Instead of going after him, you know, on a lot of policy things, they went after him on not declaring free rides I got. I guess he had, you know, a chauffeur take him to and from work, and he didn't declare that as income. You know, I think it was technically a violation of tax law, but he paid it in full. And yet that was the way in which, you know, they got him out of that job. So, you know, we've seen it on both sides of the aisles. And it is unfortunate that it keeps happening. And we'll see whether it happens this time around or not. I think it's a lot less likely because Republicans control both houses of Congress, and obviously controlling the Senate means that they're the ones who are going to control whether or not the nominee is confirmed.
Back when you were nominated, it was a 50-50 senator in 2001, right?
Yeah, it was. And moreover, there was the ability to filibuster, which there no longer is. So the change in the filibuster rules, I think, is the big change.
When you say after you sat with Governor Bush in Austin and he offered you the position, what did you need to do personally to take the job in the first place?
Well, it was a long, arduous process. I mean, I'm very interested that nobody seems to think they have to come up with tax returns. I had to come up with 3 years of tax returns. I had to fill out voluminous paperwork on my finances. I'm not quite in the category that some of Mr. Trump's nominees are. It was a rather simple process for me. But I remember when the whole issue of the woman living in my home came up, they wanted me to come up with tax returns from the years that she had lived with me, because I actually did pay a housekeeper, and that was on my tax returns, at least part of that time that she was living with me. And I remember we had to go back, and I had to ask my accountant to dig it out of storage, because I had, you know, they were over 10 years old. This is something that had happened a decade before I was ever nominated. This was not like it had happened the day before I got the call from Governor Bush. So it was heavy, heavy lifting, having to go back and list every address that you'd ever lived at. I mean, it was not an easy thing to do, and had to do it quickly, had to get the paperwork in, and basically had to open up your life to examination.
You mentioned that you felt that a lot of the attacks on you were personal and less about policy, but there were, I mean, certainly liberals were going after you on your opposition to raising the minimum wage. You were a critic of affirmative action. These are the same things that Andrew Puzder, the Labor Secretary nominee designate this time, is going through the same things on those issues.
Yeah, and I think had I ever gotten to a hearing, the hearings would have been focused more on those. And it was interesting, you know, when before I got the job, when I knew I was just in the running for the job, the Bush transition team asked for every single article I had ever written in my life. And I'm a writer. I'm prolific. I've been writing, you know, since the early 1970s and going back and putting together huge binders of all of the articles. And what was interesting is they read them all. And when I had my first interview prior to being offered the job, I met with the vice president elect, Dick Cheney, and Governor Bush and President elect Bush. And they had clearly, you know, somebody else probably had read all of the volumes, but they had pulled out some articles. And one of the articles that they questioned me about was my position on the minimum wage. So there was a lot of vetting. I mean, this was a very, very professional operation. They were not buying a pig in a poke. They really knew what they were getting with me because I had been writing so much. And I was told that the Washington Post and New York Times and others had, I mean, that literally you know, a dozen or more reporters had been assigned to read everything I had written. So there was a very good vetting process.
Boy, if this happened today, you'd have to mention the fact that you're on the Political Junkie, right?
That's right. I'm sure they'd hold that against me.
You know something? I was also thinking that I know this situation is not exactly the same, but when Zoe Baird was nominated by President Clinton to be Attorney General in 1993, you were a pretty strong critic on her. Now, of course, it was different. She hired an undocumented couple, and they paid no taxes on their wages. But I think the fact that they reminded you that you were also a critic of Zoe Baird didn't help your case. Is that fair to say?
Well, you know, it's very interesting that you say that, because I remember the old Lehrer NewsHour actually pulled out a clip, and it was played many times during the controversy. I went back and watched the full clip, and first of all, I wasn't being questioned about Zoe Baird. I don't think I said very much about Zoe Baird at the time. It was, and I'm now blocking on who the person was who was up. I think it was for the CIA, but he had a similar situation where he hadn't paid taxes on an employee, and that would seem to be more of the concern. But, you know, my position on immigration and how we should deal with trying to bring in and legalize people who are in the country illegally has been absolutely consistent forever. I mean, again, I've written on this. So I thought that Lehrer NewsHour was a little dishonest in the way in which they took that clip and edited it and took out the part where, first of all, I didn't say anything about what my view. I said that the American public, I think, was reacting to the idea that the taxes had not been paid.
Well, you talked about hearing a clip that may not have been completely honest. I want to play a clip of your news conference where you announced your withdrawal.
I am here today in part with the folks around me to try to put a human face on a story. But I am also here because I think that what has happened over the last few days is quite typical of what happens in Washington, D.C., and unfortunately is very typical of what has happened in politics in America today. And I believe that what has happened is part of what we've seen over the last several years of the politics of personal destruction, is the phrase. I believe that I would have made a great Secretary of Labor. I believe that President Bush is going to make a great president. I worked very, very hard for his election, and I want his administration to succeed. Unfortunately, because of the way in which the stories have played over the last few days, the fact that all of you have made, I think, a great deal more of this story than need be, and have, in my view, not told the story of some of the people around me, I have decided that I am becoming a distraction, and therefore I have asked President Bush to withdraw my name for Secretary of Labor.
You talked about the politics of personal destruction. Do you think that still exists today?
Oh, absolutely. It's much worse today. I mean, I think the polarization that's happening in American politics today is, in my view, a real threat to our republic. I think, I was not a Trump supporter. I was one of those never Trump Republicans. I did not vote for Mr. Trump. I didn't vote for Hillary Clinton either. I wrote in Marco Rubio's name. But he was elected, and I think the election was legitimate. And I think to try to delegitimate the election is not a good thing. It's not a good thing for America. And I don't like the kind of personal attacks that are made. I don't like the way in which you can't just disagree with somebody. They can't just be wrong in your view on policy. They have to be evil. They have to be bad people. You've got to demonize them. I think that's just very, very dangerous.
And that's on both sides, isn't it?
It's on both sides, absolutely. I mean, Democrats do it to Republicans. Republicans do it to Democrats. I mean, I think what was done to President Obama, the whole birther issue, was absolutely disgusting. So, you know, I mean, and obviously, President-elect Trump was the father of the birther movement in many respects. And so, you know, I mean, it's been done on both sides. But I think it's very bad for America. I think it's bad for democracy. And I wish we could get beyond believing that we have to demonize people with whom we disagree. They're not necessarily bad people just because we disagree about policy. And elections are about change, and one side wins and one side loses. And the way, you know, to settle those differences is in the next election, not by trying to stop the democratic process from going forward and allowing the person who was elected to make the changes that he or she said they were going to make.
Given everything that you learned in 2001, given all that you went through, would you say, would you go through it again? Was it somehow worth it?
That's a hard question to answer. I'm of the age now that I, you know, don't see that kind of future, and I'm doing things that I loved to do in writing. I'm writing fiction now in addition to my nonfiction, and so I see that is the direction I want to go. Would I tell somebody who was younger and more ambitious that it was worth doing? I'd say that you have to go into it with your eyes wide open, and you have to be prepared for the worst. So I would hesitate to do it. I'm very pleased that there are people who are willing to do it. I don't know that I would ever do it again.
Linda Chavez is the head of the Center for Equal Opportunity. She's also a syndicated columnist and, for a brief moment in 2001, the nominee to be Secretary of Labor. Linda Chavez, it was a pleasure having you on the program.
Thanks, Ken. Well,
while Republicans take full reins of the government on January 20th, Democrats are still figuring out how to respond. The DNC is holding its winter meeting next month in Atlanta to, among other things, elect a new national chair. Among the candidates is Ray Buckley, who heads up the party in New Hampshire. He's also the president of the Association of State Democratic Chairs. Ray Buckley, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Thank you for having me, Ken.
Well, I have an easy question and I have a tough question for you. I'll start with the easy one. What happened to the Democrats in 2016?
I think the seeds were sown when the DNC dismantled Howard Dean's 50-state strategy following the 08 election. When we stopped investing into our state parties and into the communities, that network that gave us the extra boost in both 06 and 08 and gave us those fantastic victories went the other way. You know, in 08, the average state party received about $250,000 per year. And now it's down to less than 100,000.
Now, usually when I ask that question of not somebody running for a national chair, but just when I ask that question, I always hear James Comey and the Russians and the WikiLeaks and all that. But you're talking about really the infrastructure in the Democratic Party.
I believe that there are a number of things that are added to the closeness of this election. But despite James Comey, despite WikiLeaks, despite the nominating process messiness, that we still could have been victorious. This election was close enough. An election for other offices down the ballot were close enough that if we'd had a robust operation going throughout the country, we would not have suffered the losses we did. And New Hampshire is a prime example of that. For the first time in New Hampshire history, we now have an entire Democratic congressional delegation. We have a robust grassroots operation in every county in our state, and it shows. And that's why in 2014 and 2016, we were able to push back against the national trend. We need to do that on a national level.
I want to get to New Hampshire in a moment, and I agree with you completely. 2014, with Gene Shaheen's reelection, and, of course, the picking up of the House seats in 2016, and the Senate seat, one of only two in the country. But I asked you, I said I had an easy question and a tough question for you. The easy one was what happened. I think the tougher question is, how do you fix it? How does Ray Buckley fix it?
First, we do need to address the nominating process. There are a number of things that we need to do before we even get into the conversation about the next steps. We need to make sure that the next chair of the DNC is above reproach when it comes to neutrality. And what I bring to this race is the fact that I've been the state chair of both the 08 highly contentious nominating First Nation primary and in 2016. And there's not a hint that I in any way put my thumb on the scale for any of the candidates. In fact, I fought very hard to make sure that Bernie Sanders was on the ballot, took my Secretary of State to task. That's first. Second, we need to reform the delegate selection process, the superdelegates, so that every state's delegation reflects the vote of their primary or their caucus. We need to do away with the idea that the DNC will participate in a joint fundraising agreement in a primary. We need to streamline the caucuses so that it is clearly understandable for the media and for the voters that this is what a caucus is. The fact that they are so dramatically different from state to state, who participates in it, how they participate, how long it takes, is so different. We need to streamline that a lot. So really, we need to focus on that first. The second step I would immediately do is re-engage the membership of the DNC. The officers of the DNC, the executive committee of the DNC, the full membership of the DNC, and allow them to be part of the decision-making process. I think that's very important, especially when it comes to the debate schedule, that instead of allowing the chair to simply decide, the executive committee of the DNC should actually vote on the debate schedule and really allow people from all walks of the country, from all walks of life, participate in that conversation. I think that's an important thing. Now, the second thing is to heavily invest in our state parties and really rebuild. That is going to, I think, go a long way in addressing our messaging problem. For too long, we have relied on hundreds of millions of dollars worth of television ads to bring our message to the voters. It's not working anymore. And the fact that you have the same commercial running in Arizona that you do in New Hampshire or you do in North Carolina and in Wisconsin, that doesn't make any sense. What we need to do is have a neighborhood-based relationship. So it's one neighbor talking to another neighbor and talking about the issues that they care about. Our platform is fantastic. The problem is you can't have the same exact ad everywhere because there is interest by state or by region, with even in a state, and that's what people want to hear and they want to talk about. Some parts of our country is doing very well economically, so jobs isn't that big of an issue. But obviously in the Rust Belt, that's a critically important issue to address. So having neighborhood organized ground operations, whether it's neighbors talking to neighbors, that, I believe, will address our entire problem with delivering the message.
You know, earlier you and I were just talking about, we were talking about the successes the Democrats had in New Hampshire in 2014, 2016, bucking the national trend. But we also did see, and you kind of alluded to this too when you're talking about superdelegates, we did see that division, the Democratic division in New Hampshire, especially the fact that Bernie Sanders won the primary with big amounts, and yet when all was said and done, Hillary Clinton had almost the same number of delegates as Bernie Sanders because of the superdelegates.
And I think that that's why it's important for us to address this, and moving forward, there are proposals that will make sure that the delegation reflects the vote of the voters, whether it's in a caucus or in a primary, and I very much support that. I know that people were frustrated in 2016 that you couldn't change the rules, not midstream, but almost at the end of the stream, but that's not how our rules were set up to do, and you couldn't ask people to unendorse people. So let's take what we learned in 2016 and apply it to make sure that in 2020, there's absolutely no question that every primary and every caucus and every activity of the DNC is completely neutral and completely fair.
When I read articles about the battle for control of the DNC, it seems like every headline suggests that the race is between Keith Ellison and Tom Perez. How does Ray Buckley break through that mindset?
Well, I think that the national media, the DC folks, are familiar with Keith and familiar with Tom, and so they tend to focus on the two of them. And that's fine. But the fact is that neither have the majority of the votes. And as we get closer to Atlanta, and in fact, that day, I doubt very much that any of the candidates are going to have a majority of the votes. So there will be multiple ballots, and we will go from there.
I was looking at your Twitter page, and there's a photo up there of four women. It's Congresswoman Ann Custer, Senator Jean Shaheen, Senator Maggie Hassan, and Congresswoman Carol Shea Porter. These are four Democratic women, and all were elected since you became chair in 2007. Is there a campaign ad for you right there?
Well, I think that it is critically important that when the voters of the DNC take a look at the records of all of those who are seeking the DNC chair's position, what exactly have they done? And what is their record, their real record, the record of what you would want in a chair? There are some people who confuse being chair of the DNC with being president in the sense of talking about specific policy positions. The chair is a mechanic. The chair is the person that makes sure that we win elections. And we have thousands of elected officials that espouse policy. We have hundreds of top elected officials, governors, U.S. senators, members of Congress, mayors, that are all involved in the development of that policy. And our job is to amplify that, to make sure the message is getting out there. But it is about making sure that the party is neutral, it's fair, everyone is treated in a respectful manner, everyone is involved and engaged, and that we build the ground operation that whoever our nominee is, that they're successful.
Ray Buckley has been the state Democratic chair of New Hampshire for nearly a decade and is a candidate to chair the national committee. You can find him on Twitter at Chairman Buckley. Ray, it was wonderful having you on the show.
It was great to talk to you again.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question. Natalie Portman, who is up for her portrayal of Jackie Kennedy, was a Golden Globe nominee for Best Actress in a Motion Picture for Drama. She didn't win. What actress played the last politician to win that award? The answer? Meryl Streep, in 2012, for her portrayal of Margaret Thatcher in The Iron Lady.
Your problem, some of you, is that you haven't got the courage for this fight. No, you haven't had to fight hard for anything. It's all been given to you, and you feel guilty about it. Well, may I say, on behalf of those who have had to fight their way up and who don't feel guilty about it, we resent those slackers who tick, 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 and contribute nothing to the community.
Of course, according to one prominent critic, her performance was overrated. Anyway, the randomly selected winner is Steve Gilmore of Charlotte, North Carolina. Steve wins the coveted political junkie button. And don't forget, we still have a scuttle button puzzle out there waiting to be solved. You can find that, as well as our political columns, trivia questions, and much more on our website, krpoliticaljunkie.com. Of all the fake news stories that distracted everyone in 2016 was the one that Pope Francis had endorsed Donald Trump's candidacy for president. While it was, on the face of it, ridiculous, many people bought into it. Here's some tape from some of those fake sites.
The Pope, by his own words, has actually endorsed Donald Trump as not only a Christian, but as the next president of the United States.
News outlets around the world, according to this website, are reporting on the news that Francis has made the unprecedented decision to endorse a U.S. presidential candidate. A statement in support of Trump was released from the Vatican just yesterday.
Well, that's the fake news about the Pope. What's real about Pope Francis is that he's one of the most admired people in the world. The first non-European pope since 741, more than 1,200 years ago. The first ever from South America. No bulletproof Pope-mobile for him. He rides in an open car to be among the people. And he talks about divorce and abortion and climate change and gay marriage. Mark Shriver has written a biography of the Pope. It's called Pilgrimage, My Search for the Real Pope Francis. In his day job, Mark is president of Save the Children's Action Network in Washington. And he's also part of the most famous Catholic family in American history. His mother, Eunice, was the sister of John F. Kennedy, the nation's first and only Catholic president. Mark Shriver, it's great to have you back on The Political Junkie.
Thanks for having me, Ken. Really appreciate it.
Well, tell me, why a book on the Pope? I mean, there are already a bunch of them out there. So tell me, why is yours different?
Well, I think that, this is not a traditional biography. There have been some great books written about the Pope from the biographical perspective. Austin Iverly wrote a brilliant piece. He was a Englishman who was a Jesuit and, you know, did his PhD in Catholic Argentinian history. This is a different book. This is a quest biography. It's a story of a journey that I undertook to figure out who he was, to get a better sense of where he came from, his family life, and to talk to and learn from the people that were his friends, his colleagues, but also his detractors, and to tell his story through their stories. So it's not, 35 pages of the economic crisis that happened in the early 2000s. It's more pages from the perspective of people that lost their jobs and lost their careers during that economic depression in Argentina and how the Pope interacted and supported them. So it's a quest biography. It's not a traditional biography, and I think that sheds new insight in where he's going and trying to lead the Catholic Church. So it's a different perspective on Pope Francis.
The title of the book is My Search for the Real Pope Francis. Did you find what you were looking for? And tell me, what did you find?
So there were so many questions about the man, including the fact that he's the first Jesuit ever elected pope. The Jesuits actually make a commitment to never aspire to higher office, to become a bishop or a cardinal, much less pope. And actually, if a Jesuit feels that a fellow Jesuit is trying to get a better job, they're supposed to report him. So there's built-in humility into that order. How did that guy, Pope Francis or Jorge Mario Bergoglio, how did he, as a Jesuit, become a bishop, a cardinal, and then pope, the first one ever? How did he have a huge rise to power as a 36-year-old man where he oversaw all the Jesuits in Argentina and Paraguay, and then just a little over a decade later had a fall, was exiled, and then came back as a different, more powerful leader over the course of the rest of his life? So there were all these questions, I think, that needed to be answered. And the journey, the book, Pilgrimage, is really that journey. Did I find what I was looking for? I mean, I think the book is a good insight into who the man really is. And what I found is he is, like a lot of great Jesuit priests, he's a fantastic teacher. He challenged me to my core, and he challenges so many people, whether you're Catholic or Jewish or Muslim or atheist, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican or an independent. Pope Francis doesn't fit into a political box like we want to always put him in America, Ken. You know, we want him to lean as a Democrat or a Republican, to be conservative or progressive. But this guy is a great teacher. He challenges us all to really live more meaningful lives, to live lives grounded in mercy and in faith and in humility. And that's a challenge to everyone, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, whether you're conservative or liberal or an independent. And that's why I think he's so exciting and interesting to understand.
Well, in the book, I mean, it talks about that you went to Argentina to speak to the people who knew the Pope in his early years. What did they tell you about those early years?
Well, he came from a very devout family. His mom and dad left Italy. Famous story of his mother standing up on a chair in the middle of a town square in Italy and denouncing Mussolini. They sold their coffee shop, moved to Argentina. So he is the grandson of immigrants. His father traveled over with the mom and dad, heavily grounded in Catholicism. He born, 14 months after his parents got married. Grandmother Rosa, who was Italian peasant, lived just a few doors away and helped raise young Jorge Mario Bergoglio. But it's an earthy Catholicism. It's not the theoretical and heavy theology Catholicism. It's learning the lives of the saints. It is going to Mass on a regular basis. It's saying the rosary. It's very earthy Catholicism instilled in him from a peasant from Italy. And that had a huge influence on him. And I think today, you know, when he made his first trip as Pope, it was to the island of Lampedusa to be with the folks that were fleeing across the Mediterranean and whose family members were dying in that sea. And I think that that's really an impact he had from growing up in a family with immigrants, poor families. And I think that also speaks to his commitment to not only serving the poor, but being with the poor and accompanying them on their life's journey. He's got this image, you know, Ken, the Jesuits always talk about being a man or a woman for others. And Pope Francis has really evolved that. And it's not only being for others, but being with them as well. And I think that concept of accompanying people on their life's journey, it's so powerful. And that sense of humility, which I think he got growing up from his mom and dad and from his, particularly from his grandmother, that sense of humility is really important. And gosh, we could use some humility and mercy in our political debates and discussions from our religious as well as our political and civic leaders. More humility and mercy would be great, I think.
And what do you think makes Pope Francis the man he is today? Or to borrow from the Hebrew, why is this pope different from all other popes?
Well, you know, I think it's funny how you make reference to the Hebrew. I think he is really committed to accompanying people on their life journey, and that he doesn't differentiate between Catholics and other Christians or Jews or Muslims. He has so many friends, real friendships. I mean, I talked to a number of rabbis and Jewish dad who lost a loved one in a fire in Argentina. And he really, you know, has real relationships with these people. He listens to them. He learns from them. Doesn't try to change them. Doesn't tell them they're wrong in their religious beliefs. He really reaches out to people of all different faiths and all different nationalities and tries to move them, as he does me, an American he's never met, to understand and to be more merciful and more mod and more humble in our approach. So I think that that's what differentiates him. I think he has these real relationships with people. He really wants to listen and to learn, and he wants to accompany people on their life journey. So it's not very flamboyant. It's, you know, he doesn't have a 5-year plan. He doesn't think in those boxes. I think he really wants person by person to try to change the Catholic Church as he tried to change person by person Buenos Aires and Argentina in general.
One of the things I was struck with by reading this book, and I do not mean this as criticism, I promise I don't. This is just an observation, but it seems like, you know, we talk about pilgrimage. It seems like a big part of this book is about Mark Shriver's pilgrimage. I mean, you talk about when you ran for Congress and you lost, and as I remember you running, I thought your defeat was unexpected. When you lost your dad, Sergeant Shriver, years later, how did that affect your faith?
Well, what I was trying to, you know, when I entered into writing the book, I had become a little disillusioned with the Catholic Church hierarchy. Not the men and women who are priests and nuns who are doing great work, not only here in Washington, D.C., where I live, but, you know, I've seen priests and nuns all across this country and all across the world doing great work. But, you know, what was going on in Rome with the Vatican banking scandals, the sexual abuse scandals, comments about Islam and women just didn't resonate and didn't, you know, line up with what I thought the Catholic Church should be doing and what I saw in so many cases it actually achieving. So that's why I wanted to jump in. I think I clearly had, you know, losses, but politically as well as personally, and it led into this search for Francis in hopes that he could teach me some profound insights, to teach me how to live my life with more joy, to be more merciful and more humble. And I think that's why I jumped into the book. You know, I use the example of my own loss in politics because it's an exile. It's, you lose, you're, you know, no longer in politics. You are having to face a different type of situation in life. And that's what happened to Jorge Mario Bergoglio, Pope Francis. He was sent away in 1990. He was exiled. He lost a great deal of responsibility and was sent with no responsibility into the interior of Argentina, where he came out of that and emerged a different type of leader and a stronger leader. So, you know, the journey, the pilgrimage, I try to weave my own story in there to only in the way of trying to show people, surely we've all experienced loss. We've all had our own moments of exile. And have we come out of those stronger and different, like Jorge Mario Bergoglio, Pope Francis did when he was exiled?
You know, I remember seeing over and over so many pictures of photographs in people's homes of the Pope and John F. Kennedy. I mean, very, like one right next to the other. And I suspect that, you know, in 2017, by where we are now, that a lot of people don't have any idea who Jack Kennedy was, or Bobby, or Teddy, or Teddy, or your dad. But millions and millions, maybe billions of people around the world know who the Pope is. What do they see when they see Pope Francis?
That's a great question. I think, you know, I think people that I've talked to and listened to tell me that they see a guy who is non-judgmental. They see a guy who clearly believes in the rules, you know, the commandments, but who realizes that we all, including himself, are sinners. I mean, he had this comment, Ken, when it was the end of the Extraordinary Jubilee of Mercy in December, which he called, it was a year-long celebration of the concept of mercy. And at first, you know, when he announced it, I thought he meant, you know, I had to be nicer to people or maybe write a bigger check to my favorite nonprofit. But he's talking about mercy at a completely different level. And at the end of it, he said, you know, he went on that story of Jesus when a woman is brought to him who's caught in adultery, and the folks wanted to stone her to death, and they asked Jesus what they should do. And he said, let the one without you, the one without sin, cast the first stone. And everybody leaves. And then the woman standing there, and Jesus is drawing in the dirt, and he says to her, where'd everybody go? And she said, they left. And he said, did they condemn you? And she said, no. And he goes, nor do I condemn you, but go and sin no more. And of course, Jesus had to know that the woman was going to sin again, like we all do, right? But I think what Bergoglio, when he told this story, said, you can choose either mercy or misery. And he said, I choose mercy. And I think he's trying to change us. Rules are important, and they need to be adhered to. But we're all going to break them. We're all going to sin. And then the question is do you forgive people, or do you stone them, you know, figuratively or literally? And I think what he's saying, and I think he's gotten that out, he doesn't judge people of goodwill, because he knows they're going to make mistakes. But then the question is, do you forgive them 7 times 7 times 70 times? And do you try to change their heart and their behavior through that mercy? I think that's what people see when they see this guy.
Let me ask you one final question. We're entering into the age of Trump, a president who nobody can say is religious. Would you say, do you think that did the election tell us that America is giving up on religion? Or do you think maybe perhaps religion might see a rebirth?
It's you're asking a terrific question. I think that I don't think people have given up on relationship with God. I think, you know, we're all striving to understand and connect with God, with an entity that is more powerful than ourselves. You know, people are long to make that connection. They long to, I think, live lives of purpose and meaning. And I think our political leaders used to call us to make sacrifices for the common good, used to call us to put aside our own checkbook and our own, you know, ego and try to work for the betterment of all in society. And I think those are the great, those are the leaders that we look to over the years and over decades, the ones that challenge us, that don't say, look, life is easy, go out and buy more, you know, stuff for yourself. And I hope that, you know, our political leaders, our religious leaders, go back to calling us to, as Pope Francis says, you know, leave security and comfort on the shore. You know, get out of your comfort zone. You know, actually talk to and interact and learn from your neighbor. And your neighbor, you know, doesn't have to be all the way around the world. It can be the homeless guy who's out in front of your office, or the person at your in your office who you really don't like. You know, interact with them and develop a relationship with them. So I just hope as we enter the Trump presidency in the next 4 years, that we look, all of our leaders look at being more merciful and more humble. And they, I think, can learn a lot from Pope Francis and the way he interacts with the poor and the powerless and those that don't have a voice.
Mark Shriver is president of Save the Children's Action Network in Washington, and he's the author of the new book, Pilgrimage, My Search for the Real Pope Francis. Mark, it was great having you on the program.
Thanks a million, Ken. It's always great to talk with you, and it's great to get your emails and your newsletters. Wonderful stuff. Always thought-provoking. Thank you for having me.
And her face was white with fear in case her actions were absurd. So she closed her eyes to keep her conscience blind. Crying, God knows I'm good. God knows I'm good. God knows I'm good. God may look the other way today. God knows I'm good. God knows I'm good. God knows I'm good. God may look the other way today.
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken@krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. By the way, are you planning to travel to Washington, D.C. this weekend to attend the inauguration or to protest it or to participate in the Women's March happening on Saturday? We'd love to hear from you. Why are you attending? What do either of these events mean to you? And what do you think is the most important issue facing the country as the new administration gets underway? Send us a message by recording a voice memo on your phone and then email it to ken@krpoliticaljunkie.com. We may share your thoughts on next week's show. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.